This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. Next week, the final episode of Cheers will air. My guest, Ken Levine, was one of the original writers on the show. He was also a head writer for MASH and is currently creative consultant for Wings and Cheers and is developing more projects for TV. But none of these accomplishments diminished his boyhood dream of being a play-by-play baseball announcer. So several years ago, as he neared the age of 40, Levine decided that it was time to see if he could make it in the broadcast booth. Based on tapes he made with his own portable tape recorder, he landed an announcer job for a minor league team. And in 1991, he was offered a job with the Baltimore Orioles. Levine kept a diary of that year, which is now a book called It's Gone. No, wait a minute. He'll tell us about that call in just a few minutes. Levine was with the Orioles for only one season, but he was picked up by the Seattle Mariners, where he currently works. Like most people, Ken Levine was introduced to baseball in elementary school.
Really, as a kid growing up, I didn't have much exposure to baseball because I was out in the hinterlands of Los Angeles. And then in 1958, the Dodgers came to town, and that's when I really discovered it, and also discovered Vin Scully, who was their longtime broadcaster. And by the time I was eight, I already knew that I didn't have what it takes to be an athlete. In a sense, that's sort of a gift, because a lot of people wait until they're 20 or 30 to have their hearts broken. And I wanted to be a baseball announcer.
Well, you said that you were the worst outfielder in America?
Oh, yeah, easily.
Why
mean,
so
it's
bad?
Unbelievable. It was unbelievable. I don't have good depth perception, which I probably shouldn't admit being a baseball announcer, but I would stand in the outfield, and there would be a routine pop-up, and I would drift under it, and it would land 5 feet over my head.
Now, you started listening to Vin Scully and play-by-play with your dad. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. My dad really introduced me to it. In fact, my whole family was really into baseball, and I remember as a kid when you're on the West Coast, the games on the East Coast take place about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we would have dinner listening to baseball games.
Well, what was it about Vin Scully's voice, his demeanor, that really inspired you?
Well, Vin Scully had a tremendous sense of drama. He also had a real great way of communicating the tradition and the history and the lore of the game so that it wasn't just an athletic event. You really got hooked into the whole history of baseball and the tradition of baseball. And I don't know, there's just something about the way he described it. He managed to personalize the players and the situations so that you weren't just following a game night to night. It was almost like following a soap opera on a daily basis. And I really got hooked into the personalities and the rhythms of the game. And also Vin Scully has a real enthusiasm for the game. There's just something about hearing his voice where you know that he would rather be at the ballpark than anywhere else. And that was transmitted to me. And that's something that I like to take with me as well.
Well, now, were you then, you realized, as you said, at a young age that you were not going to be the ball player you had hoped you would be. When did you really get hooked on this idea of being an announcer?
Well, I thought even at the time, when I was 8, 9 years old, I thought, wow, what a great way to spend your life. You get to go around the country to exotic places like Cleveland and Cincinnati and Philadelphia, certainly, and you get to be a part of a baseball team, and you get to follow them and watch baseball each and every day and get paid for it. I thought, this is a great way of making a living. And so even at an early age, I figured this would really be fun to do.
But how did you keep that alive? And many things intervened between that early aspiration and the chance that you got at the Baltimore Orioles.
Right. Well, it's kind of tough to get jobs as announcers. And when I got done with my schooling at UCLA, I decided to go into radio, but as a disc jockey, because although I didn't see how I could pursue sports casting per se, I did fall in love with radio as a result. And I was a disc jockey bouncing around the country from Bakersfield to Detroit. So I got to see all of these exotic places anyway for a few years. And when I got tired of playing Kung Fu fighting 4 times a night for $650 a month, I figured there had to be something else. And I hooked up with my now writing partner, David Isaacs, who was schlepping film cans at ABC. And the two of us decided to try writing. You know, it's the old story. You look at what's on TV and you say, gee, I could do that. And we sat down and started writing scripts, and that began a career that has lasted 20 years and still going as a television writer. But in the back of my mind, there was still that nagging call to be a baseball announcer. I would go to Dodger games and I would see Vin Scully sitting up in the booth, and I would think to myself, what if I had taken that path? And so about 6-7 years ago, I decided, you know, it's now or never. And I threw caution and ego to the wind and grabbed a tape recorder and went to the upper deck of Dodger Stadium and just started broadcasting games into the tape recorder just to see if I had any ability in this direction. And I fell in love with doing it. I didn't fall in love with people throwing nachos at my head. but still, it was very intoxicating. And I said, you know, I would love to see what it would be like to actually broadcast baseball. So I sent tapes around to minor league teams and got a job with the Syracuse Chiefs, which is the Toronto Blue Jays AAA affiliate, in 1988. And that was how I began this folly.
Well, how would you say then the difference is broadcasting a minor league team and a major league team?
Well, it's tremendous. You can see in a major league park, first of all, the lighting is good. To be honest with you, it's very similar. It's the same game, and in many ways, it's more fun doing a minor league game because the players are not so absorbed in their contracts and agents and that sort of thing, their endorsement deals. They're really there to play the game, to make it to the big leagues. The ballparks are more intimate. It's easier for the fans to have access to the players and to be spending a warm summer evening, say in Rochester, New York, at a funky old ballpark calling a game is really a great way of spending a day.
Now, how did you actually get the attention of the Baltimore Orioles? And you were their announcer for the 1991 season. And when you got that call to say you're hired, this was, as you say, the end of a lifelong fantasy. What was your reaction?
Well, my first reaction when I was offered the job of the Orioles was elation. I had never imagined that I would actually get to the level of big league broadcasting. And that lasted for a couple of minutes, and then it was replaced with a feeling of overwhelming panic, because it's one thing to be sitting in the upper deck of Dodger Stadium annoying a couple of general admission patrons, and it's another to be broadcasting minor league baseball where you don't have a real big audience, and it's not that much of a factor. If you blow a home run call, so what? But it's another to be the voice of the Baltimore Orioles, to be on a 33-station network that blankets the entire East Coast. It's like, this is for real. This is a real job here. And then there were questions of, was I ready? Was I good enough? That sort of thing. And so for about a day, I was just absolutely in a state of panic.
Well, the title of your book, It's Gone, No, Wait a Minute, actually is a call that you made. What happened?
Yeah, that's my classic home run call. Each announcer should have his own signature home run call, and unfortunately, that's mine. No, I have made that mistake a couple of times. The reality is, if you talk to any major league announcer, Vin Scully, anyone, they will tell you, yes, there have been times when they have blown home run calls, or they have blown exciting plays, that type of thing. They've given the wrong score. It just happens. And, you know, for me, you know, early on, that was part of my problem.
So what is your signature home run call now?
You know something, Marty? I really don't have one.
Really?
No, I really don't, because I think the really good home run calls are the ones that are originated spontaneously, where an announcer will just call a home run a certain way and say, wow, that was really good. And so to sit back and try to dream up you know, wow, he will touch them all. It just sounds really phony and pretentious. And so I would rather just continue broadcasting and maybe a good home run call will come to me. Most of the good ones are already taken. It's gone. And Dave Niehaus, my partner in Seattle, has It Will Fly Away. And a lot of these guys have the good home run calls. And what you're left with are these idiotic, goodbye, Mr. Baseball, those kind of calls. And I just don't want to have one of those.
Now, you were the announcer in a particular episode of The Simpsons, and this is when Homer was the dancing Homer, the mascot for the Springfield Isotopes. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. My partner David Isaacs and I wrote that episode, and they let me be the announcer.
Being a lifelong fan of baseball, did the game lose any of its luster when you got to see it up close and you got to see it behind the scenes?
Well, it did and it didn't. It did not, in the sense that for the first time I had a chance to travel to all of these great ballparks, to actually be in Fenway Park and Tiger Stadium and places that I had just seen my whole life on TV. That was magical. But on the other hand, yes, when you see the problems that baseball is undergoing, and I remember last year we were in Minnesota when Faye Vincent, the commissioner, was fired. And I said, you know, it's kind of like the Don McLean American Pie song, that this was the day that the game died. And there is that that cloud that hangs over the game. You don't know whether there will be a major lockout next year. You're not even sure if they're going to be playing next year. The headlines are consumed by dollars and the different contract problems and labor negotiations. And the big thing to me that has hurt the game is players jumping from team to team to team. It used to be as a kid growing up that you loved your team and you loved the players who were on your team. And kids could really get an attachment to certain players. They really had their heroes. And you can't do that much anymore. Now kids are pretty much rooting for the logos of the teams, because with the exception of like a George Brett or a Robin Yount, who have played their entire career with one team, these guys are bouncing around. Dave Winfield is with his fifth team. Jack Morris is probably with his fifth team in 2 years. I mean, these guys just go where the money is, and it really has changed the game.
Is that something you would talk about as an announcer?
Yes. Yes, I would talk about that on the air.
Do you have a favorite time at the ball field?
My favorite time at the ball field is just at the start of the game, when the folks are sort of settling in, when it is still dusk, when there is still some daylight left, a warm summer evening, the prospect of a ball game unfolding before you, that's really my favorite time.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a very short break. And my guest is Ken Levine, and he's written a book about his experiences as an announcer for the big leagues, and that's the major leagues. He started at the Baltimore Orioles. He's now an announcer for the Seattle Mariners. The book is called It's Gone, No Wait a Minute. And Ken Levine is an Emmy Award-winning writer and currently creative consultant for Cheers and Wings. Also, he was a head writer for MASH. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Ken Levine. Let's talk a little bit about the end of Cheers, and I don't want to make too much of this little segue here, but it seems a lot of baseball players don't know when to stop playing, and it's often painful to watch them struggle at the end of their career. I wonder if that's true for television shows as well.
Oh, I think that's very true. I think that's really an excellent analogy. And one of the reasons why Cheers has decided to leave at this point in time is because we didn't want to be essentially the show that came to dinner. We didn't want to overextend our welcome by a couple of years. And the tough thing is to keep coming up with fresh, interesting stories. And for Cheers, this will be 275 episodes in the can before it's all said and done. And that's quite a lot for any comedy show. And so I think there was that feeling to end the show now before the show gets stale, before the audience really gets tired of these people. We wanted to go out on top.
You were involved in some of the beginning parts of Cheers. You were a co-producer 1982-83, is that right?
That's right. Yeah. It's been very strange for me because Cheers has been an 11-year portion of my life, which is more than a quarter of my life. And to see it end is very weird, especially when I think back to those early days when we started out. Most of the actors were unknowns. We were on NBC at a time when NBC was very close to just becoming a shopping channel, and nobody watched. We were kind of like an underground television show. We premiered for the week, and I think we were dead last. There was just no rating pull at all for Cheers, and yet we believed in what we were doing, and people were beginning to find the show. And it was kind of neat to be a part of, like I say, kind of an underground hit. It was a very exciting time.
Did you think it was good in the beginning?
Absolutely.
And it just needed to find an audience?
Absolutely. From day one, from the day I saw the pilot, I figured that this was something very special.
What did you see?
Well, I saw a show that, unlike most situation comedies, was really about characters and relationships. And it was also in such a warm, inviting setting. As a writer, having to spend sometimes 80 to 100 hours a week on staff, writing and rewriting and putting a show together, I think to myself, is this a setting that I want to spend time in? Do I want to be here? And the idea of a bar in Boston where folks would come together as kind of a sanctuary, to me, seemed very, very inviting.
Well, I think that's a lot of people's fantasy spot, is a friendly corner bar. I think a lot of people would like that.
Yes, I think that everybody needs support, and especially the people who inhabit the Cheers bars, by and large, are losers. By and large, they've had flawed lives. And I think they really get comfort and strength in the support that they receive from each other. And I think that's so necessary. And I think, in a way, the audience, the television audience, has been invited in as well. You're part of that group.
How much do you think of that? The prickly conversations between Sam and Diane were a kind of a spinoff of some of the repartee between Hepburn and Tracy.
Well, the original creators, Glenn and Les Charles, envisioned that. They wanted to do a Hepburn-Tracy type of relationship. And so I think that was not by accident. I think two gifted actors in Ted Danson and Shelley Long were brought aboard, and they really provided, I think, the most important ingredient, and that is chemistry. Because without chemistry, the lines can be just razor sharp and very pithy, but they're just not going to hit the mark because the two people delivering the lines don't have a real attraction for each other. And I think the thing that was so great about Sam and Diane is that the audience really, really believed it.
Was there a certain character that you had an affinity for, that you wrote for?
Yes, Frasier. For some reason, I loved Frasier. Maybe it's because I have a degree in psychology at UCLA, and it's the only use I've ever been able to get out of it. But Frasier, to me, was kind of like an intellectual Daffy Duck. And he was a lot of fun to write for.
Well, I have to tell you that David Bianculli, who does TV reviews for Fresh Air, interviewed Kurt Vonnegut for his book. And Vonnegut told Bianculli that he would rather have written for Cheers than have written anything else in his life.
You know, I'm a big Kurt Vonnegut fan, and I heard about that last year, and I was astounded that he made that comment. And to me, as a television writer of Cheers, that is the greatest compliment I think I will ever receive in my life.
Was it hard, though? And I wonder, you're talking about a show that had to sustain itself for 11 years. I'm talking about it as if it's in its past tense, and we know that there's next week. But a show that really—
And it will live in reruns forever.
And it will always live on. Whether there were periods where it was really hard to sustain the characters. And they never left the bar. You were limited by that particular room. And whether there was a low period during Cheers.
Well, there were certain story arcs that we experimented with that really didn't work through the course of the run of the show, you will see that we try certain things and then back off because it's experimental and, you know, you take your shot. There was a story runner that we had a few years ago where Rebecca was trying to get pregnant by Sam, that she wanted a baby. And that story arc really wasn't very successful. There was another one where Rebecca was being courted by a very young CEO. And we thought that might be kind of fun. And you do it for a couple of episodes and you say, no, that doesn't really work. And other times we brought in a character once for Frasier, a date. And her name was Lilith, and we thought it was kind of fun for a couple of jokes to have Frasier date another psychiatrist who was actually even more anal than him. And that turned into his wife, and it turned into a regular character. So you never really know. You just do your best. But there are periods of Cheers that we'd like back.
I wonder whether if Cheers were making its debut in 1993 and had its low first season, whether NBC or any other network would have stood by it.
Well, that's a real good question. When you look at some of the long-running comedy hits, a lot of them did not start out that well. The Mary Tyler Moore Show was not a ratings hit. MASH almost got canceled early on. And the same is true with Cheers because it's the type of show that's not, quote, unquote, a breakout show. There is not a major star. It does not have the type of theme that is going to instantly draw people to the television set to watch it. It's a show that grows on you. It's kind of an acquired taste. And since there is a certain sophistication, and since it is a show that deals really more with characters and requires more of an investment of the audience, I think a show like Cheers takes longer to build. And if Cheers debuted in 1993 instead of 1982, I say there's a very good chance that it would have a tough time finding an audience for the first year.
What are your plans for the final episode on May 20th? Yeah, you're going to do anything special?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the cast is all getting together at the Bull and Finch, which is the bar in Boston that Cheers was patterned after. And I'm going to be there, and it's going to be a great night, a big party. And then the Tonight Show is going to be filmed live from the Bull and Finch that night.
Well, I thank you very much, Ken Levine, for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Ken Levine has been a writer for MASH, Wings, and Cheers. His book about his introduction to major league announcing is called It's Gone. No, Wait a Minute. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.